It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a recent study shows stress might age a person's immune system faster. We'll talk to a psychiatry professor about ways to reduce stress and protect our mental health. First, the January 6th committee met today for the seventh time to discuss new evidence regarding the attack on Congress on January 6th, 2021, as it certified Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. The committee reviewed the impact of extremist groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys in the Capitol insurrection. It also looked at the collaboration between those groups and allies of former President Donald Trump. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What did you find surprising about today's hearing? Did you hear anything that makes you feel differently about the attack on the Capitol? What do you think still needs to be covered? What questions do you want to hear answered? And who do you want to hear from? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science and assistant dean at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Susan, today's hearing covered a lot of ground, from the internal politics at the White House to external groups like the Proud Boys. What stuck out to you about what we heard today?
Wow, there was so much. I think big picture, what stuck out to me is what's been sticking out to me across all of these hearings is how consistently those who are presenting this information, the members of Congress, are relying considerably on Republicans and members of the Trump administration to make their case. And the primary goal this afternoon was to make the case that there was a certain level of coordination between the White House and White House aides and hangers-oners, I would say, for the Trump administration, and then some of these extremist groups. And I think that they painted a very clear picture in that regard.
One of the former Trump officials to recently agreed to testify for the committee was a former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. And we saw some of that testimony today on video. What role do you, or what is the significance, do you think, of him now contributing to this committee's work?
Well, I think that when you have someone like Pat Cipollone, who had been the White House counsel, who is someone that would therefore have been very close to a lot of the discussions that were happening about the everything post-election through January 6th and then beyond, and not being willing to testify and then changing his mind and agreeing to sit down for the closed-door testimony, which we then were able to see some clips of today. I think it's one more person who can validate what we've been hearing has been going on. One of the points that they wanted to make was that he did not, in his testimony, did not contradict things that Cassidy Hutchinson had mentioned last week as far as what her experiences had been working with Mark Meadows. So I think he's an important witness. I think, again, just to point out that it's another person who was close to the administration, who's also a Republican, who is making these claims.
And as you said, a lot of the people that have testified, former Trump officials, were not testifying previously, were not speaking out about these things as they were happening. Does that speak to the committee having some success with its subpoena power?
I think that part of it, perhaps, we can attribute to its subpoena power, particularly given the fact that, as we know, Steve Bannon, who has refused the subpoena, is to go on trial next week for a contempt of Congress charge. I think that what we're seeing is that people who perhaps thought that this was going to go away, to not have as much impact, their initial reaction is to say they're not interested in participating. But then you get kind of a waterfall effect, and that as one person goes over and participates, then there's a greater, a greater urgency perhaps to also participate. And then absolutely there's the threat of contempt charges.
And one of the timelines that the committee focused on very closely today was mid-December of 2020. On December 14th, President Biden was officially, in some ways, declared president by the electors around the country. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell acknowledged that. Then on December 18th, a group of lawyers and other folks, including General Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, met with Trump at the White House, at first without any other White House officials there. Can you talk a bit more, Susan, about that meeting and why it's getting so much attention?
Yeah, I think it's really important for listeners to understand just how controlled the access is in the White House. And hearing today of what transpired with people, a group of people making their way into the Oval Office and speaking to the president without senior staff and others in the room, that just doesn't happen. And one of the accounts I read referred to this as one more example of a White House in chaos. And one of the things that came out today was the fact that when White House senior staff found out that this meeting was taking place, that there was just this mad rush for staff members to get into the room. And then there was apparently shouting and foul language being used and things of that sort, which is not necessarily how we expect things to go in the White House. And I think the key takeaway here is that this demonstrates that there were people in the White House who were very concerned about what potentially was being discussed or planned around resisting the lawful transition of power.
We're talking with Susan Johnson right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at today's January 6th committee hearing, taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. What stuck out to you today? What more do you want to hear? Let us know. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Susan, one of the things that happened in that meeting was, I believe, a draft executive order was brought to President Trump that outlined some fairly radical steps about how to preserve power and delay certification of results of the election. What stuck out to you about that?
Well, I think, honestly, at the most basic level, the fact that it was ever even drafted by anyone. And I think that these things shouldn't surprise me, but at a certain level, they still do. And the fact that there was this idea that the president could, by executive order, just say, you know, X, Y, and Z, it's still, again, it demonstrates just a lack of understanding of the democratic process, or maybe a lack of a willingness to accept the democratic process as it's out there. And it also speaks to what voices were most prominent around former President Trump at the time.
And shortly after that meeting, actually the next morning early, President Trump sent out a tweet saying that people could come to Washington on January 6th for a rally. It was going to be, quote, wild. And I think something we found out today was just the power of the bully pulpit and how much of an impact that tweet had online. Can you talk about the galvanizing effect of the president's words on Twitter?
Well, I mean, as we know, the president, former President Trump, used Twitter, many would argue, quite effectively to get his message out beyond what we traditionally expect the way a president would get his message out. And I think this was one of those examples where immediately after he tweeted, we began to see all kinds of responses to that tweet that demonstrated that people were taking his words to mean that there was going to be something very significant and potentially violent happening. And I think it's important to understand that that's the point that the members of Congress leading the hearings today were trying to get across, that there were people who were directly responding to that tweet and beginning to make plans and speak very violently about bringing handcuffs and pepper spray and get ready to fight and all of that directly as direct responses to that tweet.
And Trump associates Robert Stone and General Michael Flynn were among the people who we found out had contact with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, a lot of these groups that had online sway and were responding to the president's words. What do we find out about their contacts with those groups?
Yeah, we heard that there were people, as you mentioned, like Roger Stone and others, who were in direct contact through encrypted forums and the like, in making plans, discussing what was going to happen on January 6th. And again, that's the point of what they're trying to get across in these hearings, is that you had these people very close to the president, people who were involved in a lot of those meetings at the White House, who were also engaging with the Proud Boys leader, Enrique Tarrio, and leaders of the Oath Keepers and others.
We're talking with Susan Johnson right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She's talking with us today about the evidence revealing the impact of extremist groups in the January 6th Capitol insurrection from today's committee hearing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you still hoping to learn about from these hearings? Have these hearings changed the way you're looking at the attack on the Capitol? What do you think needs to be investigated further? Who else do you want to hear from? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Susan Johnson, political science professor at UW-Whitewater. We're looking at today's January 6th committee hearing and new evidence that was presented. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hey, Dean. So my comments are this. I think that we need to understand, even though sometimes it may appear like there's two judicial systems in this country, we must understand that there is nobody who is above the law in this country, because otherwise our democracy is not going to work. The second thing is that the statement I was just following orders or instructions didn't work for the Nazis at Nuremberg and isn't going to work now. And so people need to understand that, you know, you got to think for yourselves, because this is not acceptable and this will not allow. A house divided shall not stand.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Marcus there, I think, referring to the question of accountability for some in the White House and perhaps the president himself. Susan, what have we heard about the potential for anything beyond this committee in terms of criminal charges?
Well, as we've heard continually from the committee, is that what their role would be is to refer information to the Justice Department and for potential criminal indictment. And what there's been a lot of pressure, I would say, from people who believe that the Justice Department, Attorney General Merrick Garland, they're not working quickly enough. And a lot of people on the left in particular, obviously, would like to see more quick action. I would point to some of the comments that Congresswoman Liz Cheney has made, both during the hearings and then when she's been interviewed outside of the hearings, in regard to the way she speaks about the illegality of some of the actions by President Trump, and signaling, I believe, that there should be criminal consequences or penalties applied as high up as need be. And so I think that sometimes the wheels of justice turn slowly, and that's what we're seeing right now. But I think there's some significant urgency as well, and I'm hearing that from the caller.
Marcus, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Saul in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hi, good afternoon. I had two brief comments and a question. The comments, Steve Cipollone, I thought, was a very reluctant and sort of a prissy witness. You know, he stepped around. He acted the lawyer, but he didn't show any kind of emotional involvement. So I don't know that they're going to get much out of him. I'll find out later. Secondly, I thought he was just basically shamed into it by Ms. McCutcheon. So second thing is, they wasted a lot of time highlighting tweets and comments. Every pimply 17-year-old probably gets a big charge out of saying ridiculous things on the internet. So it would have been more useful to use FBI evaluations of what the noise was on the internet about this, rather than just citing silly comments by people that who are unidentified. The third is a question, and that is, are they going to get anything useful out of Steve Bannon, or is he just, you know, he just using this as a way to get out of his indictment?
Saul, thanks for the call. Let's pick up on Saul's second point first there, Susan. A lot of attention today on tweets, like we mentioned, the kind of impact of the president's words, but that's different than tapes, comments from the president himself. What do you think the committee's aim was today in highlighting all of those, that online activity?
First of all, I agree with the comments that that the caller made as far as both of the two comments. I think that they were trying to demonstrate the cumulative effect of many, many, many tweets, many people putting out there that they believed that they were getting their marching orders from President Trump, and that therefore when people showed up on January 6th, that they were doing so because the president told them to. So I think the goal was to show the cumulative effect because there were so many.
And Saul also mentioned Steve Bannon, who agreed recently to cooperate with the January 6th committee. That could be an interesting witness. Susan, what are you watching out for with Steve Bannon's work with the committee?
There's a lot of people who are quite suspicious of Bannon's motives on a couple of different fronts. So first of all, there's the obvious one, which is he has a trial starting next week on contempt, and a hope that perhaps his participation would make that a moot point. The judge has already indicated that's not the case. The trial is going to move forward either way. A second thing that I've read is the concern that his willingness to testify would be a way for him to spout some of the misstatements and falsehoods and propaganda as a way to try to derail the hearings and get a lot of attention on him, because we know that that should he testify, quote unquote trump a lot of what we've already heard, and it will really get people, the media, I would say, to focus a lot on every word he says, and that will detract from the other work that the committee's doing.
Time for one more call. We'll go to Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I, you know, used to be a Democrat. I voted for Democrats in the past, but I refuse to be brainwashed by what the Democratic Party is doing in these hearings. They held no hearings during the Black Lives Matter riots and Antifa damage that they did to our country. So these hearings are politically biased. I also believe President Trump had a responsibility to maintain his executive branch power, because he was president till January 20th. Now, Hillary lost her popular vote. Gore lost her popular vote. So I know the Democrats had to cheat in the Electoral College. And we know that those ballot boxes in Madison were ruled illegal by the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. And there were other illegal votes counted and illegal ballots counted.
Jeff, I'm going to jump in there because the state Supreme Court ruling did clarify election guidance, but did not say that votes in Madison were fraudulent. But Susan, to Jeff's point of political bias and presidential power until the 20th, is it safe to say that what happened on the 6th goes a little bit beyond that?
Well, I don't think that anyone is questioning the fact that President Trump was president until President Biden was sworn in. I don't think that's up for debate. I think the issue being covered right now has to do with what role did President Trump have in inciting a riot, an insurrection at the Capitol. I don't think that they're mutually exclusive.
Sure. And two other people we heard today, witnesses today that we heard from, Susan, were Stephen Ayers, who was at the Capitol on January 6th, and the former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers, Mr. Jason Van Tatenhove. Can you talk about what they brought to the hearings today?
Yeah, I think Mr. Ayers was put in front of the committee. He's someone who has been, he's going on trial for his participation in the event. And I think he put a face to the tweets, maybe in the context that he explained why he was there and that he believed that he should come because Trump, asked them to come. The court documents have shown that he put an image on Facebook saying that taking a Twitter post from former President Trump and saying that's why he was going. So that's why he was there. And then as far as Mr. Van Tatenhove, his idea was to provide background on what the Oath Keepers really are, given that he had been involved in that organization as its spokesperson. So he could speak to the role that they play in, I guess, disrupting their role in being a disruptive organization.
Sure. And Susan, in our last 30 seconds or so, what are you watching for next? What are you hoping to hear?
Well, they gave us a prelude to what was going to be covered in the next hearing, and that's going to be how President Trump behaved actually while the insurrection was going on January 6th. So, I'll be curious to see what else is there. And I do want to hear more about what Cipollone has to say. And they did tease that a little bit as well as they were closing up today.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk again. Susan, thanks as always for joining us.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
That was Susan Johnson, an associate professor of political science and assistant dean at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. She joined us today to talk about the January 6th committee hearing earlier this afternoon. Coming up after the news, a psychiatry professor joins us to look at the negative health impacts of stress and the ways to reduce stress in our lives. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, humans have tried to control water for a long time, but what about when it fights back? We'll talk with the author of a new book about how we can better live with water and adapt to it. Now, it's no secret that stress isn't good for you, but researchers are still learning more about just how harmful it is. A study published last month in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found a correlation between high levels of stress and faster aging of the immune system. It adds to growing research about the connections between our mental and physical health, and it highlights the importance of stress management and relief. We're talking about that connection now, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed stress affecting your health? What are the biggest impacts stress has on you? How do you feel it? Have you found effective ways to reduce it? What questions do you have about stress and your physical health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Melissa Rosenkranz is an assistant professor of psychiatry and distinguished chair in contemplative neuroscience at the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Melissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Dean. It's such a pleasure to be joining you today. I'm a longtime listener, so this is a really fun opportunity.
Well, great to have you with us. Melissa, I want to start by defining some terms, if we're able. Is there a working definition for what stress actually is in the body?
There is, and I think we can all agree that what an individual finds stressful is going to vary widely from person to person, but in the field of stress research, generally, a definition that's agreed upon is demands that we perceive to exceed our ability to cope. And so that, because of the perceived aspect of it, that is why what is defined as stress varies from individual to individual.
And inside our bodies, when we feel stressed and we are kind of feeling that we're unable to cope. Are there things, physical things happening in our bodies that as a researcher you look to and say, there's the stress response?
Absolutely. And this, the what's considered the stress response is really a coordinated and complex set of physiological changes that are well suited to support survival and our protection in situations that we would have encountered through most of human history. And are appropriate for supporting our well-being in those contexts, but generally aren't well-suited for the types of stressors that we experience as modern humans. And those changes are things like an increase in heart rate, an increase in mobilization of glucose from stores in our body, an increase in stress hormones. Some people might be familiar with the word cortisol, which is a hormone that's released from our adrenal glands that helps to mobilize these processes. Adrenaline, which is another hormone, also known as epinephrine, is released from the adrenal glands during stress. And these are things that we measure when we want sort of an objective measure of engagement, of stress physiology. But that experience can be interpreted differently for different people.
And when we talk about negative health impacts that these stress hormones can have, especially when they're, I imagine, released over a long period of time, multiple times, what could you talk about the range of health impacts that we see with stress?
Sure. And it really is, I think you hit the nail on the head here. It's the long-term accumulation that we're talking about when we think of the effects of stress on health. Stress is, and the hormones that are associated with stress, the physiology is really essential actually to our survival. But it's the repeated engagement of these systems frequently and chronically over long periods of time that causes wear and tear on our bodies. And so you can think of our bodies similar to how we would think of a car, that the normal functioning is doing what it's supposed to do. But when we really press that system, like if we're driving really hard and then we brake really fast, you know, repeatedly over time, it's going to cause wear and tear on that car. And our bodies are the same way. So you can think of when you would mobilize glucose from stores repeatedly and frequently over time, that might be associated with an increased risk for type 2 diabetes or the accumulation of adiposity or fat stores over time in our body that's associated with long-term health problems. Or if you get a frequent acceleration in blood pressure and heart rate over time, that's going to cause wear and tear on your cardiovascular system and be associated with greater risk of heart attack or cardiovascular disease or stroke. We can think of you know, the effects of stress on our musculoskeletal system and the likelihood that we'll experience chronic pain. Really, I often think of stress as amplifying vulnerabilities, like low-level underlying vulnerabilities that may not, give rise to an actual physical symptom without that stress, but with stress present, it sort of amplifies the underlying vulnerabilities that are there anyway.
And do those stress hormones only get released in those quick moments, or is there, I don't know, such a thing as a slow drip of stress?
Oh, that's a great question. The hormones that are associated with stress and the physiological systems are not just involved in the stress response, but they're involved in the maintenance of our day-to-day life. And so they're really essential for our functioning, and we wouldn't want to make them go away. That would be really problematic. But what's important is how is the appropriate response given the context and the regulation of that response. So turning it on when it's needed and turning it off when it isn't needed. But I suspect that your question has more to do with sort of low level chronic stressors that are sort of ever present. You can think of that in terms of like the demands, the low-level work stress that's sort of always eating at the back of our minds. And yes, those are those types of experiences are often associated with elevations in stress hormones that aren't following sort of the normal, healthy, regulated pattern. And those are the types of patterns that we would associate with increased risk of chronic diseases and ultimately increased risk of mortality or earlier mortality than we would have without those stressors present.
We're talking with Melissa Rosenkranz right now, assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison. We're looking at the relationship between mental stress and physical ill effects in the body. Melissa, I know one thing that you study a lot is inflammation and stress. You mentioned some of the negative health impacts stress can have before. Is inflammation a part of those showing up in different ways?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think inflammation is one of the sort of common denominators that connects the diseases that are associated with chronic stress. And I don't mean to say that inflammation is a bad thing. Like our stress responses, inflammation is an absolutely essential part of our immune response. And it's really the first line of defense when we have a scrape or we are infected with a pathogen. But inflammation is also mobilized during stress. And really, you can think about that in relationship to the types of stressors that we would have faced during evolutionary time, like fleeing a predator or fighting for our territory or fighting for a meal. And the likelihood that we're going to have a break in our skin or we're going to be damaged in some way. And so the immune response, the brain's perception of that stressful experience launches kind of a preemptive inflammatory response to prepare for the encounter of those pathogens. And so that would be very appropriate and helpful to us in sort of this evolutionary timescale. But when most of the stressors that we experience are, you know, tension with our spouse or managing all of our kids' activities or microaggressions that we might face in the world, that launching that preemptive inflammatory response is not going to be helpful. And it's going to contribute to the underlying conditions that give rise to some of the diseases that I've already mentioned. And those very same stress hormones in an acute situation suppress inflammation. But when those stress hormones occur sort of at low levels over a long period of time, they actually promote inflammation and they promote some of these diseases that I've talked about. And that's a really key part of what we're looking for with interventions that target stress reduction as a mechanism.
We're talking about stress and the impact on your health with UW-Madison psychiatry professor Melissa Rosenkranz. Want to get into some of those interventions you mentioned, Melissa, in just a bit. But first, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What stress management tools have you had success with? Do you practice mindfulness? Have you ever meditated? How has it gone for you? And if you've managed to reduce stress in your life, have you seen positive health effects? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Melissa Rosenkranz. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at the negative impacts of stress and the ways we can manage and reduce stress. Also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How does stress affect your life? How do you feel it physically? Have you learned to manage stress? And have you seen physical benefits as a result? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melissa, before the break, you mentioned health interventions. You also said that stress is often, you know, only one part of many factors that could be causing a health problem. That said, when someone wants to cut that variable of stress out, what kind of things can they do? What do you advise?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are lots of ways that we can reduce our stress and some that are better studied than others. And I think it's a really individual question. Some things work really well, or people are drawn to a particular lifestyle more than others. And you did mention mindfulness meditation, which is an intervention that I and my group here in Madison have studied, and others around the country as well. And that works really well for some people, but not everybody is drawn to interventions or practices like meditation. And there are other things that we can do, like exercise is probably one of the very best ways to reduce stress and to improve the regulation of your immune system. And sleep, I think exercise and sleep are like two really, really big factors that you can imagine if somebody is experiencing a lot of stress. Sleep is one of the things that's going to take a big hit. And sleep is extremely important for optimal function of the immune system. So whatever you can do in terms of having a good routine and good sleep hygiene is going to really help both reduce stress, but also improve your immune system's function in not responding when it should, not responding when it shouldn't, and responding when it should. But if we want to talk about specific practices like mindfulness, there's a fair amount of research suggesting that mindfulness practice can be really beneficial in reducing stress for sure. But having that reduction in stress translate into more optimal function of the immune system as well. And I can talk about the specifics of that if we're interested, or we can take questions from callers.
Well, you mentioned earlier that stress sort of throws off our natural rhythms of releasing things like glucose and stress hormones. Do things like sleep and exercise sort of help reset that natural rhythm in the body?
They do, for sure. And as you can imagine, all of these things go hand in hand. So if you're exercising more, you're going to sleep better, you're going to have better circadian rhythms of stress hormones and immune system function. If you're sleeping well, you're going to be more likely to, you know, have the resources to exercise or to meditate or to do the things that you know are good to support your well-being. And so all of these things go hand in hand. And if you can do one of them, great. If you can do multiple of these things, even better.
I want to go to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Dean, who's driving on the road right now. I believe pulled over. Dean, hello.
Well, hello there. I'm a 16-year stroke survivor, and because there is no defined protocols on how to recover, no one knows. There's a huge amount of anxiety about getting back to your previous life, which probably causes the 23% of stroke survivors to get PTSD.
And, Dean, have you found things in the wake of your own stroke that have helped you sort of manage those stressors, those expectations?
Not really.
Gotcha. Dean, thank you for calling in. I'm so sorry to hear about that. Melissa, obviously you can't recommend things or diagnose anything, but what sort of things could someone in Dean's position start thinking about in terms of how to reduce some of that stress and the outlook?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think that some of the practices that mindfulness, I think mindfulness actually is a really great thing to think about in these situations, because one of the things that mindfulness emphasizes is being with what is and practicing acceptance and maybe having your attention focused on the things that are going well and what new things might arise that wasn't part of your life prior to having a stroke. Even if things have shifted and you don't have the same abilities that you did before, what's new in your world that may not have been part of it before that might be a positive? And to think about what functions you may be able to regain, and having that acceptance might actually help in the process of regaining some of those functions or finding new ways of functioning in the world given the capacities that you have.
Dean, thanks for that call. We're talking with Melissa Rosenkrantz of UW-Madison right now, looking at the relationship between stress and physical health. Melissa, we've been talking about mindfulness, meditation, and I think sometimes there can be a, it's a big industry, but there can sometimes be a bit of a reluctance from some people to try it out or being not sure where to start. I'll say for my own part, I had never done yoga until about a year and a half ago. Now I really like it. For someone who has never thought about doing meditation or mindfulness, where should they start?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think this is a wonderful time to explore mindfulness meditation, if it's something that you are curious about, because it's never been more accessible than it is now. There are apps that can be used out there that are free in some cases to download, that can be personalized and can require as little as, you know, 5 minutes a day, or as, you know, as much as you want to engage with it. But apps aren't right for everybody either. Some people don't like to learn that way. They're not learners in that way that an app presents material. And so for individuals like that, finding a group, you know, there are mindfulness-based stress reduction courses that are taught throughout the city that are totally and completely secular. And so some people have reservations about learning to meditate because they think it's associated with a particular religious tradition. And that is true. Meditation practices are part of many different types of religious traditions, from Christianity to Buddhism to Judaism to Islam. But there are plenty of meditation courses that are out there that are separated from any sort of spiritual tradition and are completely accessible to someone who hasn't had any practice before and who's curious and maybe wants to meet other people. I think that's one of the benefits of the in-person courses, is that you also have the experiences of others with these practices to share in your own journey. And so there are lots of options for a diverse range of styles of learning.
And Melissa, our peg for this conversation was a study involving researchers from USC about how stress ages the immune system and makes certain immune cells behave differently over time. I know you weren't part of that study specifically, but looking at it, was there anything that surprised you? What were your thoughts?
No, it really didn't surprise me. I mean, you know, the immune system ages naturally. The ability of our immune system to rise to the challenges of the viruses and bacteria that we're exposed to decreases over time. It actually peaks generally during adolescence, as depressing as that might sound. But the rate at which the immune system function declines varies widely. And stress is one of the factors that determines the rate at which the function of the immune system declines. And so it really didn't surprise me. And it corroborates a lot of what we already know. And there are other research, actually, some that come to mind immediately are from Alyssa Eppel, who is a professor at the University of California in San Francisco, who studied another aspect of cellular aging called that's related to the length of a part of the cell called a telomere, which are just little ends of the chromosomes that protect the chromosomes. And we know that the length of a telomere is related to aging, but also to the amount of stress we experience. And there have been studies showing that the length of those telomeres can be buffered by behavioral practices like meditation. And so I think, though we know that stress does impact the rate at which the immune system and other cells in the body age, there are things that we can do to slow that down.
Well, Melissa, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melissa Rosenkranz is an assistant professor of psychiatry and distinguished chair in contemplative neuroscience at the Center for Healthy Minds at the UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the connection between stress and our health and share ways to reduce and manage stress. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, medical debt affects more than 100 million people in the U.S. That's according to a new project from Kaiser Health News. We'll look at how costs got so high and what can be done about it. also the potential impact of allowing Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs. All that and more tomorrow morning after 7 on The Morning Show. There is big news for people who like astronomy, space, or just interesting things. NASA's new James Webb Space Telescope, which launched in December, released its first image yesterday and more today. The first picture, a cluster of about hundreds of galaxies, some of which are more than 4 billion light years away. It's basically a high-definition version of the Hubble Telescope's famous deep field photo. And from where we're standing, the picture takes up about one grain of rice in the night sky. It's the deepest astronomers have ever seen into space. It was also really quick. While the Hubble telescope takes weeks to make a photo like that, the James Webb did it in just over 12 hours. NASA released more pictures today of nebula clouds and a close-up of 5 galaxies pulling each other apart in a really neat gravitational battle. Keep looking up. This is Central Time.